Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live, and I have with me today a guest whose life is so complicated and so interesting, and his name is, I'm laughing just because he's laughing, and yes, Jerry Gillies, and he is a best-selling author of a book called Money Love, which sold 2 million copies.
Something over 2 million.
Something over 2 million. Let's talk about how you got there. What was the first thing you did professionally?
At the age of 19, I got a job at a little radio station in Dover, Delaware. Mm-hmm. I had taken a broadcasting course at the American Foundation of Dramatic Arts, which mm-hmm. was in Philadelphia. And it was a year-long course, and then I got a job at this little radio station, $55 a week at mm-hmm. the age of 19. And I started a 12-year broadcasting career there, which ended up with me at NBC Radio in New York.
How did that shift happen? I know you said, I was just interested because you've done so many different things in life. Some of them, well, we'll get to them all, I guess, but an unusual combination of moments in your life. And you said, I said, I'd like to talk about how you got from thing to thing. And you said you would too, because it's been kind of organic.
Well, and yes, I don't actually think of my life as complicated. Mm-hmm. I think of it as very synergistic. I always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. My mother had done some writing and always encouraged me. She taught me to read at the age of 3. And I wrote a play when I was 11 that was performed at my school. Mm-hmm. So I got into radio by taking what I thought was just going to be a radio and television writing course. But the person running the school was a terrific salesman. He used to sell vacuum cleaners. He talked me into the whole course, which I had never thought about doing, broadcasting. That's how I got into broadcasting. But the writer in me has always been probably the strongest force, and it's led to just about everything.
And so you went for an interview for this job at NBC? I mean, you heard it was available, or?
Well, actually, I was working in Philadelphia in an all-news radio station at KYW with my colleague Andrea Mitchell. Mm-hmm. So I got to NBC before she did, but she's gone a lot further than I ever did.
So what happened after that? What was
the
next step?
One of the editors...
Because what I'm getting to is I want to get to where you started giving good advice on money and where you are now.
Well, I went to NBC because one of the editors at the Philadelphia station became news manager at WNBC Radio. And he had always liked me, and he hired me. Mm-hmm. Then I began to become a specialist there on finance. I did business reports for the network.
Because that came naturally to you, that sense?
I had always been interested in the stock market mm-hmm. and in certain aspects, particularly the entertainment industry, which I actually got approval to do a newsletter from the SEC on the entertainment industry, and that never materialized because I got busy doing other things. So I started doing business reports. Mm-hmm. And I realized that there were certain psychological attitudes connected with people who were successful. I interviewed a lot of big money makers in New York. Mm-hmm. And the ones who were really happy and successful, to me that was an important combination. Because you could be successful and unhappy.
Sure.
And just financially successful. And I found they had certain things in common. So that sort of began that whole thread of what's the psychological, emotional attitude that leads to financial success and not only making money, but enjoying the use of it, using it well.
That's what led to your book, Money Love?
That's what led
to
Money Love.
So that was kind of the next step?
Well, not actually. I became also a resident expert in NBC on psychology just because I was more interested in it than any other newsman there in radio. And so when anyone came along who was a psychologist, I'd be the one assigned to interview them or had written a mm-hmm. self-help book. Mm-hmm. I did a documentary on the human potential movement, which was just starting then. Esalen out here on the West Coast, just getting going in the 70s. There was an institute in New York that was sort of a duplicate of Esalen on a much smaller scale, Orion. The director of that, Harold Streitfeld, who was a psychologist who had a book out called Growth Games, said, Jerry, why don't you run groups. You'd probably be terrific at it. Well, I had never thought of doing that, but he saw something and he said, I'll co-lead a group with you. I think you'd have fun doing it. And we did a what we called a singles encounter group on a Valentine's Day. And it was immensely successful, and I turned out to be good at it. He had seen something I never suspected.
I see something also, and I'm sure you do at this stage of your life, is that you're remarkably fluid.
I still am, yes.
Yes, insightful, and willing to jump into whatever pool seems to need your insight. You talked about somebody being an excellent salesman. I have a feeling you are.
But I don't like to do it. I don't like to market myself.
Well, I think just your attitude does, your abilities.
Yes, to a great extent, but you know, when it comes to going out and putting energy into marketing.
No, I didn't mean like that.
But you're probably right.
I mean, people, I would think, have confidence in what you present.
Yeah, I think so. There's a certain level of integrity, I think, that happens with people who are successful in marketing and sales, that people know they at least believe what they're saying. And sometimes that's not true, of course, and it's usually found out. We see that in politics all the time.
Yes, you do.
Sometimes really, you know, people don't believe what they're saying, and pretty soon, I think even the average person gets a sense of that.
Whether a person is, believes
being
what...
Being authentic.
Being authentic, right, or saying what's needed to get them,
And one of my criteria now that I've really put a lot of focus on is wanting to be around people and also wanting to make an effort to be this myself. Someone who says what they're going to do and then does it.
Yes, ABC should always come up ABC.
Yeah, action and words connected. Yes. You say what you're going to do and you do what you say you're going to do. And that's so simple, but it is all the difference between someone who's authentic and isn't.
I want to go back to a couple of things. I know I wish we had a week here, and I know we could really use it. How did you get to go to writing your book, Money Love, that was such a success? And what is it that people have in common who are successful?
Well, there are a bunch of things, but it actually was my fourth book. My first book was about relationships, because once I started doing these workshops, I did workshops about male-female communication. And I wrote a book called My Needs, Your Needs, Our Needs. And I fell in love at a psychology conference with a psychologist in Miami. And I ended up moving to Miami and doing a workshop called The Love Lab there. And then teaching at Miami-Dade Community College on the psychology of emotions. And still writing, mostly writing. And Money Love happened. There was actually a man in San Francisco named Leonard Orr. And he was the first person I ever heard talk about how your attitudes toward cash, toward money, dictate your financial results in life.
What would those attitudes be? Oh, some people are not comfortable with it.
Mostly coming from your parents. If your parents lived through the Depression and they had fears about money and they weren't comfortable with money, or when they had money, they weren't comfortable in spending it on something that was pleasurable. That all had a lot to do with how much money you had in your life and how well you used it and how you made it grow.
So attitude is contagious, for sure.
Attitude is very contagious, and I began to explore that, and I began to come up with exercises people could use to define that for themselves.
So people can still get your book?
Money Love is available. It's out of print. It's available on Amazon and other places. And this is mind-boggling. $800 for a brand new paperback copy on Amazon.
No.
Mint condition. That's a brand new, but you can find it for probably $2 or $3 in used copies. And someone came to a workshop I did recently at Unity San Francisco and said they bought one at a used bookstore in the city for 75 cents.
My goodness. Okay, that's a large range.
Big range, yes. Well, that's how my life has been. Very big range.
Okay, I want to get to some of the other range. So you were giving financial advice.
Well, not financial advice.
Oh, okay.
It was really psychological advice connected with money.
Okay.
In other words, what are your attitudes? It wasn't about do this and you'll become a millionaire. But a lot of people became millionaires as a result of the book.
Yes, do this and improve your relationship.
Get rid of the negative barriers.
Get comfortable.
Yeah, get rid of the negative poverty consciousness, as I termed it.
At what point did your life take a turn that you served a jail sentence?
Well, that was a wild one. I'll try to compress it.
Because okay, yeah, I'm sure you have to. Yes.
I'm working on a prison memoir that will, you know, probably be 300 or 400 pages.
Okay,
I still won't cover it all. But I'll sort of give you the brief circumstances. I met two people who were very successful nutritionists and longevity experts. Mm-hmm. They'd written a best-selling book. I met them in a green room when I was promoting one of my books. And they came up with a lot of great nutritional formulas. They were geniuses in the laboratory. And I started taking them religiously, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, now I didn't know this at the time. In fact, I didn't know this until I'd been in prison for 2 years. One of them had this very powerful herb from China, Ma Wang, which is ephedra.
Oh.
And I was taking it 3 times a day for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And what I didn't know was it was changing my behavior, my ability to think clearly, and I ended up hijacking a motorhome.
Oh my goodness, what a bizarre
thing
to do.
Isn't that weird? It was bizarre, and was badly done. I would have been so much better a criminal if I were in my... Now, at the time, I thought I had just been going a little crazy. I thought I had some kind of brain malfunction.
Well, do you remember what it was that said to you, take that motorhome?
Yeah, I had had a legal case that I sort of wanted to escape from. And I thought, well, if I go off somewhere in a motorhome, I can write a book, make a lot of money.
Why didn't you buy one?
Because I didn't have any money.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, my assets had been frozen. And I lost money on a major investment overseas.
Okay.
And some other people had lost money. And one of them, just one of them, was blaming me. And that's how I got involved in
now,
this legal
tangle. Isn't that kind of a harsh thing to have happen, that you get a prison sentence from your first and only?
Very harsh, but it happened in Contra Costa County, which is known for its harsh, you know, they brag about 99% conviction rates and maximum sentences. It was probably illegal, but I couldn't afford an attorney to fight it.
Okay.
I had to go with a public defender who was paid by the same county that paid the district attorney, of course.
So how
and
long
the
were
judge
you,
how and long, the police.
How long were you in jail for this?
12 years.
12 years for essentially stealing a car?
Well, carjacking, but it was a motor.
Oh, you mean actually somebody was in it?
Someone was in it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that.
And they jumped out after pummeling me to the ground. I had zapped them with an air taser, which I, then turned off because the sparks kind of shook me up a little bit. I sort of came to my senses very briefly. He socked me a couple of times, jumped out of the motorhome. If he had stayed in, I probably would have gotten life for kidnapping. So I drove off, but I didn't get very far. As I said, it was pretty stupid. I didn't even have directions to the freeway. I didn't even bring a map with me. And
try not to laugh.
Yes, I ended up in the Martinez County Jail. And within a day or two of my arrest, I all of a sudden got mental clarity and said, what in the world was that all about?
Uh-huh.
It didn't make any sense to me, as it doesn't to anybody.
But you've been convicted.
And I had no idea why. I thought I had some kind of brain attack, and I was worried for the next 2 years it would return, and I might go totally crazy.
So you served a whole 12 years?
Yep.
Charles Manson is up for parole every 7 years.
Oh, yeah, and the guy that cut off the gal's arms and left her to die in a freeway, he got out in eight years.
Yeah, and so Dan White, okay.
Yeah, everybody was astonished at both the harshness of the sentence and the fact that it was me having committed that crime. No one ever guessed what my crime was.
No
guard or fellow inmate. Never. They looked at me and they said, oh, white collar.
You would think.
That's
what I was expecting you to say.
You know, here I was in my 50s and convicted of what's considered a violent crime, although there was no real violence involved in that
situation. Except for what they pummeled you.
I was more damaged. Right. The guy had a little red scar from the air taser, but he didn't even fall to the ground, so it wasn't a very... And I had checked out the air taser because I wanted to use a non-lethal weapon. Image in Las Vegas, I bought it after they tried it on me.
Because
they were testing it out on potential customers.
Because you knew you were going to do this?
I knew at that time, yeah. You know, a couple weeks ahead.
So 12 years in jail, and you must have learned a lot. We'll wait for your memoirs. I'm eager to see those.
Well, the biggest thing I learned, or one of the biggest things, was 2 years in, I got a cellmate who had been a meth addict. And he said, as many people had, you must have been on drugs when you committed this crazy crime. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I've never done drugs. I don't even drink. And then we started talking, and
the ephedra.
He said, that's how I made my meth. He said, you may as well have been on meth. And then, of course, it all came together. And I checked with a doctor who was an expert. He said, oh, yeah, that's exactly the kind of behavior a lot of people have reported.
Gosh. So after that, now you're out of jail.
I get out. And
how long ago was that you got
2008.
Out? Okay, so not so terribly long.
And
so
I was on parole for 3 years. I couldn't go further than 50 miles from San Mateo County, where I didn't know a soul, so I had to live there, which I'm still doing, and about to leave.
What's the first thing you did to find a job or take care of yourself?
Well, I luckily, when I got out, amazingly qualified for Social Security.
Oh.
In my broadcasting career, now I left to become a writer after 12 years. That 12 years was exactly long enough to qualify me within one quarter for Social Security. If I had worked one less month, I wouldn't have qualified. So that was able to take care of basic subsistence income. And then I decided to sort of explore where I wanted to put my energy.
And where was that?
Into writing and of late into comedy. I had written some comedy back when I worked at NBC, in fact, for people like Phyllis Diller, Henny Youngman, who became a friend. A couple of people like that. Not full-time, but I would write pages of jokes for them and sell them at $100 a page, which was the going rate at the time. And then I wrote in prison cartoon gags for major cartoonists, for Playboy, for the Harvard Business Review, for the Saturday Evening Post and the Wall Street Journal.
So you were never stopped in your creative work. You were just relocated, essentially. You were working from a different
office. I even wrote
a
mystery novel. I love mysteries, and I always thought I'd write a mystery novel.
Where is that now?
In prison, I wrote it. It's sitting there. My agent said, you need to rewrite this and put more suspense and make the villain worse, nastier. And I just never got around to rewriting it, which I may do someday. But I also am working on a prison memoir. I have two blogs.
And do you want to give a website?
Absolutely.
Sure, please.
Money Love Blog, one word, moneyloveblog.com.
Okay, MoneyLoveBlog.
BLOG.
BLOG.com. And the reason I spell this out is because if people, you know, miss one letter, they're off on some other planet. Okay, thank you.
And now, there's also, you can access a 39-page ebook free from that website. And also it's called The Money Love Manifesto, and it talks about my whole prison experience in the appendix, but I talk about some of my new strategies since I wrote Money Love about developing a prosperity consciousness, and it's gotten rave reviews, and at some point I might make it an actual book-length piece, but it was one of the things I did early on. And then I created this audio series. Every month I produce a prosperity audio.
Okay, so people don't have to miss out on anything that you've done, or
no, it's there. I had a very successful audio series on the Money Love concept for Nightingale Conant, who, of course, are the biggest motivational
I've heard
purveyors, and that for a number of years was a bestseller, and it's also out of print now because that was in the 80s into the 90s.
Now, what about what you're doing now? Your comedy routine. Can you tell me about that?
I'm doing two things. I'm starting to be out there now and doing some Money Love talks and workshops.
Oh, you're doing some at Unity, aren't you?
I did one at Unity, and I'm going to be
Unity Church in San Francisco.
Right.
Has really marvelous speakers.
Oh, yeah. Our mutual friend, Alan Klein.
Yes, yes.
And many, many other great speakers.
Alan Klein, the jollytologist.
Right. And Martin Borison, who you interviewed, I interviewed for my audio series. And we may be doing some things together because we're both fascinated by how do you change your perception of time?
Oh, yes.
This is something I almost wrote a book on about 20 years ago. How do you speed up time when things aren't going that well, and how do you slow it down when you're having a fantastic time? I believe that's possible.
Why not slow them down when they're not going so well so you can learn the lessons more?
Well, because I'm not a masochist. Get through that stuff fast.
Okay.
I mean, I suffered and raged against the injustice of my being in prison every day in prison for 1 minute, and that was it.
Oh.
And I got rid of it.
Good for you.
And I, in fact, teach people how to do that. Because you don't need to, as Martin says, you don't need more than a moment to meditate.
That's
you don't
right.
need more than a moment to get to acknowledge your bad stuff and get rid of it. You don't
That's
have to
very
wallow
good
in
idea.
It.
Yeah. Yes.
So with that, in that way, we can control.
I mean, I think most of us have had days where we spend days just so irritated.
Well, that's about not mastering time.
Uh-huh.
And not choosing where to put our attention. It's all about focus, really. Because there's all kinds, as you said, my life's been full of all kinds of things. It's where you focus your energy.
Well, and so, speaking of using time well, it just, I think for the average listener or somebody just talking to you or reading about you, you have lived several lives already.
And concurrently, sometimes.
Concurrently, and I can see that you're not half done.
You're not nearly.
Right.
Well, I wrote a book called Psychological Immortality back in the 80s about using your mind to extend your life. And in there, I declared that I would have a 150th birthday party. And I have planned it. And I'm hoping some of my friends will be around to come. Or if not, there'll be new friends.
New friends, exactly.
And I expect to be dancing away the night at that age.
Good.
I don't expect to be
a wallflower. Right.
Right.
Tell me about what you're doing for the Marsh Theater.
They asked me because I had done a one-man solo performance at the Marsh in San Francisco last year.
Oh, you did already.
And Charlie Varon, who's one of their great...
I love
him. Well, he recommended me to the Marsh Berkeley. He was the director of the one I did in San Francisco. He's a fantastic director and...
He is so
amazing
funny.
Performer.
Yes, and whatever he's done, I've seen twice. I go and then I make people come with me. Okay.
Well,
that's
so Charlie
company.
Got me connected with the series at the Marsh Berkeley, and I decided to do something different than I had done there. That was all about my prison experience, and I may do that as a one-man show in New York at some point. I have a friend there who's a producer. But I decided to do five segments from my life, and I called it The Five Unpeelings of the Jerry Onion. And talking about some of these aspects, my broadcasting career, my prison, my next venture, which is becoming an expatriate.
Oh, yes.
And living in Panama, which I'm going to do
so
early
planning,
next year.
So you're planning on living there forever, as far as forever goes, I understand.
Well, for the foreseeable future, certainly, until the next slice of the onion shows up.
Why Panama?
I have a very good friend there, Tony Bussey, who's very established. He's been living there 6 years. He divides his time to some extent between Panama and New York, where he has a business. And he said, and this was when I was on parole and didn't have a passport yet. He said, you got to come to Panama and you're going to want to live here. It's wonderful. It's very inexpensive to live. It's got a fantastic culture. The people are great. There are many, many expats here who would love to hear what you're offering. He was a big fan of Money Love. He says it led to his business success. And I finally agreed to go and visit, which I did last month for 10 days. But I had already decided to move there at that point.
Well, and given that we live in an internet world, you won't be removed from anyone.
Oh, not at all. In fact, my closest friends and loved ones are on the East Coast and in England. And I'll be closer to them in Panama City than I am in San Francisco.
And you can always fly back to do
exactly.
a performance. Or
exactly.
fly back, fly anywhere. Well, as far as... next ventures. Could I ask you about a short, small next venture for me? And that is love letters. So since I am about love letters and you are a writer and somebody who's so astute psychologically, it probably won't be hard for you. Sometimes it's tricky. People have to learn how to do it.
Well, let me tell you something that just popped into my head and I have never talked about before. I wrote love letters in prison. When some of the inmates found out I had been a writer, they asked if I would help them write letters to their girlfriends and wives.
Let's just talk about that because
including
I don't really,
poems.
It doesn't matter what aspect of love letters we talk about to satisfy me. But I think when you, people who put something down in handwriting, stamp it and mail it, and it shows up on somebody else's doorstep, it's like a bag of emeralds, I think.
Absolutely.
So you were kind of their Cyrano, or you just helped them express what they really felt?
Well, sometimes it got more involved. I was the Cyrano, and I think their girlfriends fell in love with them anew, but they were really falling in love with me, or
yeah,
at least my
words. Yeah, that's the
problem
with being a Cyrano.
But since I wasn't in direct contact with the women, it didn't cause a problem. I didn't have to worry about getting shanked in the middle of the night.
Right. So, if you were to write, oh, that's so nice, though, helping people write. I mean, it's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate it a lot.
Oh, it's important.
Getting
yourself. Because we've lost that, and it's putting back the human touch.
And also, those letters last for generations.
You can't
play your Betamax. I mean, I say this all the time.
I know.
Whatever high technology you're using today is going to change shortly, and you won't be able to access it.
I was in a green room once with a man, Sheldon, what is his name? He wrote a lot of the top TV shows, like
Leonard?
I Dream of Jeannie. No,
was it? Oh, yes. Okay.
I'm not sure it was Sheldon, but you know who I mean? He was a great...
Anyway, he
was Groucho Marx's best friend. And he said Groucho was the best letter writer.
How nice.
Hundreds of letters, and that it was a lost art. And we were talking about this 25 years ago. It had become a lost art. And how important writing letters
can be. Well, what about for you, though? Who do you have to write a love letter to? Well, I mean, I can think of 15 people already in your life that I would want to write one to. But do you have family?
No. No, I have one cousin. So we exchange long emails.
Does this cousin have children?
Yes. But I haven't seen them since they were toddlers.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because these letters seem to float down generations. They get found 50 years from now. Sometimes they get found even longer than that. And somebody will know something about you.
Well, I got a lot of letters in prison.
You got
them. And I've saved a bunch of them.
Oh, good.
And I saved copies of the ones I wrote.
Okay.
And in fact, before I go to Panama, I want to go through them and save the really special ones and maybe scan them. Because otherwise I'd be carrying too many cardboard boxes with me.
But what will you do with them after you're 150?
Well, before then, I might put some of them, selected portions in my prison memoir.
Yes, but the actual letters, when people find those, it's like a pot of gold, I really think.
I know, but I, you know.
You could just.
I think early on, my ego said, someday there will be a Jerry Gillies Memorial Museum, and I will give them all my artifacts and correspondence, but I don't really think there'll be that kind of interest.
Well,
I don't really.
I mean, even if you leave them in some chest of drawers. For somebody who buys that chest of drawers later, found letters are a portal to wonderful worlds.
Well, and if anybody's interested, I'd be happy to sell them right now.
Oh, I might be. Okay, we'll talk about this afterwards. Oh, I'm so glad you did this with me.
Me too.
Yes, thank you.
But I do have one caveat.
Please.
And it's a pet peeve.
What?
I have the most horrible handwriting.
Mm.
I can't even decipher it.
Okay.
I consider letters just as personal and intimate if they're typed.
Oh.
I've been typing since I was 11 years old. I got special permission to type my homework in school because no one could read
my
handwriting.
Well, somehow, okay, you know, your handwriting is yours.
Right.
So for that alone, I think
it's
worth a lot.
Well, my typing is mine, too.
But,
I had a friend in prison, an old girlfriend, who said, I'm not going to correspond with you unless you do it in handwriting.
Okay, so maybe this is one of those instances where not doing it in handwriting is okay if it's really illegible and it's kinder. But bad handwriting is not a reason not to do it in handwriting. But the old royal typewriter, when you see letters written on old typewriters.
Oh, yeah.
It's, I think, almost as good because it is kind of a fingerprint of that era.
I had an Underwood.
An Underwood. Perfect. And that's something unique. That's not computer generated. I don't know why I think that's not as good. But
All the letters I wrote in prison, I had a typewriter.
Yes.
We couldn't have computers.
But you signed them.
Oh, yes.
Okay,
and I addressed the envelopes by hand.
Ah, good. Okay, so there's something of you there. That's
yes.
important. Well, thank you,
And
dear.
If I ever wrote a letter in hand, it had to be printed because no way would
okay.
anybody. Even I can't read my handwriting.
That's a good tip. But there's just so there's some stamp of you on it. Thank you very much. And I think you should all remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion, and as you look back, you may find that you have already done some. Until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye.